church is in Africa, at the service of reconciliation, peace and justice.
The church is in Africa, at the service of reconciliation, peace and justice.
This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In today's program, you can hear our feature, Health and Healing. First, however, our bulletin of church news, followed by African News Panorama. I am Festus Tarawali. Pope Francis continued his cycle of catechesis on the Acts of the Apostles at a general audience on Wednesday in St. Peter's Square. This week, the Pope used the experience of St. Peter to urge Christians to allow themselves to be amazed by God's surprises and creativity with which he makes himself known as the Lord of all. Robin Gomes reports.
The starting point of Pope Francis' catechesis was the experience of St. Peter in the Acts of the Apostles, where he has a vision of a large tablecloth with four-legged animals, reptiles, and birds descending from above, and a voice asking him to eat their meat. As a good Jew, Peter refrains from eating anything impure, but the voice repeats, "What God has made clean, you are not to call profane." God then sends Peter to preach Christ and his forgiveness to the household of Cornelius, a non-Jew who is God-fearing and given to works of charity and prayer. Filled with the Holy Spirit, Cornelius and his family are baptized by Peter in the name of Christ. But Peter's fellow Christians rebuke him for going against the custom and the law. However, the Pope said, Peter experiences freedom from himself in greater communion with God and with others, because he sees God's will in the action of the Holy Spirit.
Con questo fatto il Signore vuole che Pietro non valuti più gli eventi.
The Pope explained that through this episode, God wants Peter not to evaluate and categorize events and people as pure and impure, but to learn to go beyond, to look at the person and the intentions of the heart.
Impariamo che un evangelizzatore non può essere un impedimento.
Pope Francis said that from Peter we learn that an evangelizer cannot be an impediment to the creative work of God, who wills everyone to be saved, but one who fosters the encounter of hearts with the Lord. I'm Robin Gomes.
In a tweet after the audience, Pope Francis emphasized this call for an evangelizer not to be an impediment to God's creativity. Today, writes Pope Francis, we ask for the grace to allow ourselves to be amazed by God's surprises, to not hinder his creativity, but to encourage hearts to encounter the Lord. He ended the tweet with the hashtag General Audience. Pope Francis on Wednesday sent a message to the Director General of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, Ku Dong-yu, for the October 16th World Food Day. Sean Patrick Lovett reports.
In the message, Pope Francis calls attention to the distorted relationship between food and nutrition. He cites the fact that while 820 million people suffer from hunger in the world, almost 700 million are overweight. He calls it a cruel, unjust, and paradoxical reality that there is food for everyone, and yet not everyone has access to it. The Pope laments the fact that food is wasted, discarded, and consumed in excess, or destined for other purposes than nutrition. Poor nutrition gives rise to pathologies caused by excess, says the Pope, giving the examples of diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and other forms of degenerative disease, but also of deficiency, as documented by an increasing number of deaths by anorexia and bulimia. This reality calls for a conversion in our way of living and acting, adds the Pope. Nutritional disorders can only be combated by the cultivation of lifestyles inspired by gratitude for the gifts we have received and the adoption of a spirit of temperance, moderation, abstinence, self-control, and solidarity. By adopting a more simple and sober lifestyle, continues the Pope, we grow in a fraternal solidarity that seeks the common good and avoids the individualism and egocentrism that serve only to generate hunger and social inequality. Pope Francis goes on to stress the primary role played by the family. Within the family, and thanks to the particular sensitivity and wisdom of women and mothers, we learn how to enjoy the fruits of the earth without abusing it, he writes. Pope Francis concludes his message for World Food Day by stating that the battle against hunger and malnutrition will not end as long as the logic of the market prevails and profit is sought at any cost. Our first concern should always be the human person, writes the Pope. We must come to realize that what we are accumulating and wasting is the bread of the poor. I'm Sean Patrick Lovett.
The theme for this year's World Food Day is Our Actions Are Our Future, Healthy Diets for a Zero Hunger World. Pope Francis later tweeted saying, Let us work together so that every person can have access to adequate food according to the will of God. Hashtag Zero Hunger. As part of this year's observance, FAO prepared this public service announcement encouraging people to adopt healthy diets.
Did you know that unhealthy diets are the number one cause of death worldwide? Billions of people lack the essential vitamins needed to live a healthy life. It's time to change the way we eat. We need to cut down on highly processed foods, fats, salts, and sugars. And we need to diversify our diets.
More at www.fao.org.
A press briefing on the work of the ongoing synod for the Pan-Amazon region was held on Wednesday in the Holy See Press Office. Christopher Welsh reports.
At the press briefing on Wednesday, Paolo Ruffini, the prefect of the Dicastery for Communication, summarized some of the main topics at the center of discernment for the Synod, including the Amazon region as a paradigm for the earth as our common home, a calling to ecological conversion, enculturation, access to the sacraments and education, ministries, as well as social issues like migration, rural and urban life, and international and multilateral engagement for human rights. He said participants at the Synod felt strongly the need to focus on an overall unified vision guided by the Holy Spirit rather than getting caught up too much in details. Father Giacomo Costa emphasized once again that the synodal path is very different from worldly gatherings. It's an experience marked not by discussions or debates like a secular parliament, but rather has a spiritual dynamic marked especially by fraternity. The first guest speaker, Ms. Yesca Patiachi Teori, an indigenous woman from Peru, spoke about the role of native peoples as guardians of the forest, while noting that care for our common home is the responsibility of everyone. She said that her people are facing a real threat of extinction and already have the experience of being discriminated against. Bishop Ambrogio Spreafico from Italy spoke about the Synod as an ecclesial event, with repercussions not only for the Pan-Amazon region, but for the whole world. He mentioned the importance of an integral human ecology, especially in light of Pope Francis' teaching in Laudato Si, which he said has not been well understood. The fraternal environment at the Synod was also mentioned as a highlight by Bishop Wellington Tadeu de Queiroz Vieira from Brazil. He also spoke about the crisis of vocations, not only in Amazonia, but around the world, and said that the question of vocations should not focus primarily on celibacy, but on holiness. Finally, Bishop Pedro José Conti, also of Brazil, spoke about the role of the laity. He said they were not merely helpers of the clergy and religious, but had their own unique lay vocation, which he called an antidote to clericalism. Bishop Conti noted the importance of finding a balance in producing goods from the land and emphasized the necessity of drawing from the ancient wisdom of the native people. I'm Christopher Wells.
The Vicar General of the Diocese of Marsabit in Kenya, Father Racho Ibrahim, is lamenting the effects climate change is having on livelihoods in that part of the country. He told Father Paul Samosumo that climate change is real in Marsabit, an outpost located in the vast desert of northern Kenya.
Climate change is real for us in Marsabit. And sometimes when we hear people being against what the Pope is advocating or those who know what it means for the climate changing, we feel very sad. Because the temperatures there now have hit very high. Life is becoming so difficult for many people, and especially in that arid area. And therefore, we want to advocate for people to change their heart, to understand that climate change is real and something needs to be done. For example, Marsabit as a town, in the previous years, is a place where we have rains 3 times a year or even several times, and it's cloudy misty in the morning and all this kind of thing. But these days, as early as 7, the sun is up there, very hot and no rain. For the last 1.5 years, there is no drop of rain in the entire Marsabit diocese, Marsabit County. And therefore, this means what? This means a problem to the community. This means the livelihood of the people are affected. And so we say that climate change is real and therefore something needs to be done. And of course, when there is no rain, what happens? This happens. Our people are pastoralists. They keep animals. They are nomads, moving from one place to another. So if there is no rain, there is no grass, there is no water for the animals. All the animals have died. Half of the animals that people own there have perished. And that means the livelihood of the people is cut short. So people cannot even sell the animals to buy foodstuff. They cannot even slaughter those animals to eat. And therefore, things are becoming difficult and heavy for them.
That was the Vicar General of the Diocese of Marsabit in Kenya, Father Racho Ibrahim. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
The main FDU in King opposition party in Rwanda says its leader, Victoire Ingabire, is undergoing psychological torture. The statement from the opposition comes a week after she was summoned and questioned by police over a recent attack in the northern region. 51-year-old Ingabire has denied any links to the 8th October attack, which killed 14 people in Munsanze district near Volcanoes National Park, which is a popular tourist spot. In the statement, FDU Inking said that the police had summoned Ingabire for further questioning without her lawyer. Last week, the spokesperson of the Investigation Bureau of the Rwandese police said he could not give details about the ongoing investigation into Ingabire. A strong critic of President Kagame, the FDU Inking leader served 8 years of a 15-year prison sentence for belittling the 1994 genocide after questioning why Rwanda's official memorial did not remember any of the Hutus who were murdered. Ingabire believes the case against her was politically motivated, arguing that most of the 800,000 people killed were ethnic Tutsis, but Hutu moderates were also slaughtered by the Hutu extremists. Since her release after presidential pardon last year, she has had to report every month to the prosecutor's office. South Africa was on Wednesday hit by power cuts after a number of Eskom generating units broke down. State power firm Eskom said it would cut 2,000 megawatts of power from 9 a.m. local time until 11 p.m. on a rotational basis across the country. This was the first power cuts in around 7 months. Eskom produces more than 90% of South Africa's electricity, but has been challenged by technical faults at its fleet of mainly coal-fired power stations. The power company said close to a quarter of its roughly 45,000 megawatts capacity was offline on Wednesday because of unplanned breakdowns and faults, including boiler tube leaks and a broken conveyor belt for coal. Reuters said that Johannesburg residents who have grown used to frequent power outages over the past decade expressed renewed frustration about the impact of power cuts on their lives. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta on Wednesday commissioned a new $1.5 billion United States dollars Chinese rail line. The stretch connects the capital Nairobi to the Rift Valley town of Naivasha. The extension links to the $3.2 billion United States dollars line between the port of Mombasa and Nairobi that opened in 2017. The development of Kenya's railways has been part of China's One Belt, One Road initiative. This is a multi-billion dollar series of infrastructure projects upgrading land and maritime trade routes between China and Europe, Asia and Africa. The inauguration of the railway line on Wednesday took place amidst delays in establishing an industrial park in Naivasha to drive freight traffic. The Mombasa to Nairobi link that opened in 2017 also suffers from underutilization of its cargo services. Both sections were Chinese-funded and Chinese-built. Kenya had planned to open an industrial park in Naivasha, offering companies tax breaks for investing in manufacturing and preferential tariffs for electricity generated in the nearby geothermal fields. But that has been delayed. President Kenyatta was re-elected for a five-year term in 2017 after promising to develop the East African nation's infrastructure. The railway was his paid project, but it has been dogged by problems. Archaeologists have found more than 20 ancient wooden coffins near the Egyptian city of Luxor. The country's antiquities ministry said the coffins, whose brightly colored decorations are still visible, were uncovered at the Theban necropolis of Asasif on the west bank of the River Nile. They were in two layers, with the ones on top across those below. The ministry described the discovery as one of the largest and most important in recent years. Most of the tombs at Asasif, which is close to the Valley of the Kings, are from the late period of ancient Egypt. But there are also tombs from the earlier 18th dynasty, which was the first of the new kingdom, and included the famous pharaohs Akhmos, Hatshepsut, Thutmose III, Amenhotep III, Akhenaton, and Tutankhamun. More details about the discovery will be released at a news conference on Saturday. You are tuned to the Daily Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
You are welcome to Health and Healing. The World Health Organization, the WHO, announced recently that it had added 28 medicines for adults and 23 for children on its essential medicines list. Among these are 5 cancer therapies, which WHO said are the best in terms of survival rates in treating skin melanomas, lung, blood, and prostate cancers. Dr. Nicola McGreen is a cancer specialist working with the World Health Organization. He explains how these new medicines could transform people's lives in rich and poor countries.
We evaluated several new cancer drugs and came to the conclusion that according to the new criteria, there are drugs that can make a difference. In particular, immunotherapy for melanoma is definitely a drug bringing large benefits to patients. Drugs for some leukemia and lymphomas were examined, so multiple myeloma, for example, is a highly curable now disease. And we identify criteria for evaluating and screening new cancer drugs for candidating them for being essential.
And how many essential drugs are there that countries should have?
Currently, we list with the new update 460 medicines, meaning a pretty large set of drugs dealing with the whole spectrum of human diseases, from emergencies to more rare ones.
So we have progress on these new cancer medicines, and the point about this is that they have fewer side effects, presumably. That's why you're promoting them. They need less monitoring, perhaps?
Actually, the main criterion for selecting new cancer medicines is large benefit. That's the criterion we identified, meaning drugs that provide a large impact on survival, do prolong the life of the people. That's the main criteria. For sure, safety is also an important criteria. When you have a drug, oral, easy to take, and not having heavy side effect, that's surely another criterion.
You mentioned tuberculosis medicines. You are now suggesting that the new oral medicines should be used as opposed to the injected ones because they are less harmful.
Yeah, in full alignment with the most recent WHO guidance, we listed all the new oral regimen, oral only, meaning it's now preferred for patients to take oral drugs, even for TB. Several drugs have to be taken for a long period. And certainly the new regimen avoiding injectable old drugs are certainly a big improvement.
And there's also progress on an alternative to warfarin, which is a blood-thinning product or medicine. What's the new development here?
The new oral anticoagulant were examined for both efficacy and safety, and they proved equal or slightly superior to warfarin, that is an old drug that needs monitoring. And the committee examined this drug once again. They were already examined 2 and 4 years ago, and it was decided they can be valid options, and though they can remain costly drugs, but the lack of monitoring and the fact that they are easy to take has been judged as an important benefit and should be then be an option for patients.
And let's just talk about another drug that pregnant women might be interested in, carbetocin, as opposed to oxytocin. This is for use after childbirth to stop hemorrhaging, to stop bleeding.
This is an important drug for weak health system. Let's be clear, it's not a drug where you have well-preserved cold chain, But in many countries, oxytocin has been difficult to deliver due to the lack of full refrigeration systems. So where oxytocin is not available, this is now a fully valid alternative.
Dr. Nicola Magrin, a cancer specialist working with the World Health Organization, speaking there to Daniel Johnson. Last year, the International Agency for Research on Cancer released a report showing that the probability of suffering from a cancer has risen in every country around the world. 1 in 5 men and 1 in 6 women worldwide now develop cancer during their lifetime, and 1 in 8 men and 1 in 11 women die from the disease. In 2018 alone, 9.8 million people died of different cancers. The most common cancers today, the report added, were lung cancer of the breast in females, and cancer of the intestine, also known as colon cancer. Together, these three cancer types were responsible for 1/3 of cancer death in the world last year. Most of the death occurred in Asia, followed by Europe, North America, South America, and Africa. The main causes of the current cancer burden include aging and consumerist lifestyles, as well as poverty and infections that create favorable grounds for the development of certain cancers. The World Health Organization said on Tuesday that it had also updated the essential list of its diagnostic tests. A diagnostic test is an examination to gather information which aids in determining a condition or disease in a person. Some examples of diagnostic tests include X-rays, biopsies, pregnancy tests, medical histories, and results from physical examinations. The World Health Organization noted that the importance of these diagnostic tests is finding out what is wrong with the patients before it is too late. The list issued last year concentrated on priority diseases such as HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and hepatitis. This year's list covers more non-communicable and communicable diseases. Dr. Adriana Velakis is the World Health Organization's official in charge of updating the essential list of diagnostic tests. She explains why diagnostics are important.
Diagnostics are very important for patients before they start any treatment. The sooner they can know what is their disease, they can get the most effective treatment. It is important for countries to have these diagnostics available, community level, but also in highly specialized hospitals and laboratories. And then we have a tier approach, like a community and then general hospitals and then specialty hospitals.
Which developments are new? What changes this year?
On the medicines, they have 462 out of 40 years. We have 122 in 2 years. So there's really a lack of getting the list approved, and many that were not recognized before. So now we have 122 out of there about 50 that should be used at community level, no? That can be used whether it's by the patient themselves or in the healthcare centers.
Let's talk about sickle cell anemia. You say there's been an improvement in diagnostics in that. It affects sub-Saharan African states. Tell me more about it, what the problems are, how many people are affected, how this could help.
Sickle cell is an inherited disease that causes anemia. And then if not targeted soon, the consequences are bad for the patients. The sickle cell testing was approved this year, but only for laboratories. We're looking into point-of-care technologies for sickle cell. And since we talked about it, now 3 or 4 organizations have already contacted us and they want to submit for next year so that we can have point-of-care sickle cell testing at community levels.
What does it involve? What is the test?
The tests, some of them are new tests, so they're doing clinical trials now, but it will be basically a drop of blood.
That can be tested in the point of care, in the clinic?
Exactly.
In the community. And do you have any follow-up on your recommendations? How many countries are following your guidelines?
Well, the essential diagnostic list is very new, but we had a big impact even from last year. That was the first one. So countries are becoming interested, and then now they are trying to review their lists, their national lists, to see how can they add these ones. And then also the laboratory networks are looking into the list again. So we hope we'll have a huge impact, but we're looking into that for the next years.
between medicines and diagnostics, which is the easiest one to implement? Which ones do doctors accept more easily or not?
Well, WHO has been living with medicines and vaccines for 40 or 50 or 60 years almost. And the area of in vitro diagnostics and all the other medical devices, the technologies themselves, just very recently. We really need to move and very fast, because we're in the 21st century. It's time that we recognize that technology can really help us live better.
Dr. Adriana Velakis, the World Health Organization's official in charge of updating the essential list of diagnostic tests, speaking there to Daniel Johnson. And lastly, the international community observed the World Mental Health Day last Thursday, October 10th. The main objective was to raise awareness of mental health issues and mobilize efforts in support of mental health. There are millions of people who suffer from mental illnesses or disorders. This year's World Mental Health Day focused its attention on the increasing cases of suicide. Suicide is the act of killing oneself. And that was Health and Healing for this week. This has been John Baptiste Tumusime.
You have been listening to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Culture and Society, and our Bulletin for Young People. My name is Festus Tarawali, and do join us then. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.